Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Am I old here? Can y'all hear me?
Is it all the way over? Try that.
All right.
Yeah, can you hear me? All right. Shabbat Shalom. And what do you typically say coming up to a festival? You don't say that at Hanukkah. Did you know that? You don't say it at Hanukkah or Purim. Well, you're supposed to say Hanukkah Sameach or Purim Sameach because it doesn't have a Kedusha, okay? It doesn't have the sanctification. And it's distinguished that it is not one of the seven Hagim, one of the seven festivals, by the way we say, and also there is no Kiddush for Hanukkah or Purim, okay? And so that's an important aspect. It's something that you really want to remember. You might not recognize the importance of it at this point, but hopefully later on you will. Now, a lot of people believe, well, Hanukkah's not really in the Scriptures. It's all over the Scriptures. Frankly, to teach Hanukkah, you're throughout the entire, every aspect, from the Torah to the writings, to the prophets, to, of course, the New Testament. One of the major aspects is going to be concerning the abomination of desolations, because we have that where Yeshua spoke of this. By the way, we see Yeshua in the book of Yochanan, John chapter 10, verse 22. We see him in Jerusalem at the temple at the festival of Hanukkah, where it says dedication in Hebrew, that is Hanukkah. But we have where Yeshua is speaking in the Olivet Discourse. We also see this in Mark chapter 13. But we see, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, abomination of desolation in Hebrew is sikuts somit. Okay, sikuts somit. And the actual word that you have for abomination here is going to be sikuts. And that becomes important. It says, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place. When it says the holy place, in Hebrew it's the HaKodesh. HaKodesh is one of the three rooms of the holy temple. Now, the Holy Temple, massive structure, huge, gigantic. And there are some 300 buildings that we know of that were in the temple compound. And so when we're talking, though, about the temple building, you have three primary rooms, and then there are 38 offices around that in that one structure. But this is the second most important room, the HaKodesh. This is the room that has the seven-branch menorah. It has the Shulchan Lakam HaPanim, the table of the bread of the face, and it has the Mizbeach Zahav, the altar of incense and the golden altar. Now, notice that it says standing in the holy place. And we're going to find that the word sukkutz means literally an image, an idol. Because a lot of people think, well, could it be, I got asked this just last Tuesday at our Hanukkah party, could the abomination of desolations be Islam? I guarantee you that Islam is to be an abomination of desolation, but it's not what's spoken of here. And there's a difference there. We're looking at an actual image. And this image, and we're going to find that it stands actually in multiple places. In other words, not that it's mobile, that they move it around, but that there were more than one, and that it's going to be located at a number of places. But one of the places, very definitely, is within the HaKodesh, or within this room. And so, whoever reads, let him understand. We have basically the same reading in the book of Mark, chapter 13 and verse 14. Now, he made reference, when you see the abomination desolation, as the prophet Daniel spoke. So we find it numbers of places in the book of Daniel. And specifically, it's going to be on the wing of abominations. This is going to be a derivative of this that he shall confirm, talking about the false Messiah. We'll go over that a little bit later. A covenant, or actually this will be a treaty, which, by the way, this treaty is spoken of, that I know of, four places in the Tanakh. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many, meaning many Jews, for 1 week, or 1 7-year period. But in the middle of the week, the middle of the 7-year period, he shall bring it into sacrifice and offering, And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. There's one thing that I want you to remember from this slide. Right here where it says in the middle of the wing. So we have 7 years, 3.5 years in. He's going to bring it in to sacrifice an offering. Now we're going to find that the abomination of desolations, which is set up, is not set up exactly at the same time. They're close, but not precisely at the same time. We have also in Daniel chapter 11, for ships from Cyprus, okay? Now I'm using a New King James here, but the actual Hebrew is Kittim, K-I-T-T-I-M, but ships from Kittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved. Kittim is the Hebrew way of saying Rome. Therefore he shall be grieved. Now, this come against him is literally speaking right here. The hill is Antiochus Epiphanes, of course, the villain of the story of Hanukkah. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he, Antiochus, shall return and shall regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, right here, which is the holy temple. The sanctuary fortress, then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolations. Now, notice, and this should be fairly easy, we have a lot of prophecies that reoccur. There's a very famous statement in Israel that prophecy is unfulfilled history. History is fulfilled prophecy. And it's like a circle. It's like a cycle. Now, before, in our verse in 9:27, was referring to the future, the false Messiah who is to come. Here, we're looking back, and what we see is that the hill is Antiochus. What happened before happens again. It is a picture of what is to occur. And so to kind of bring you up to date on this, we have Alexander the Great comes. And Alexander the Great comes, and he is actually very favorable towards Israel. They go out and they basically give him the keys to the city, literally, of Jerusalem. And the high priest went out and met him. And unlike many of the other nations that he's come against, where he comes in and he conquers, he doesn't do that here. He passes on through to Egypt, conquers Egypt, and he passes away. His kingdom is divided with four of his generals. So one of them takes Egypt, the Ptolemies. And the Seleucids take Damascus. And Israel is sandwiched between the two. Now we have different Ptolemaic leaders, we have different Seleucid leaders, and they're constantly fighting back and forth. And so the battleground frequently is going to be in the land of Israel. And so we come to Antiochus the Fourth. And Antiochus the Fourth, unlike the previous Greek rulers who tolerated the faith of the Jewish people, that Antiochus wants to impose Hellenism. And so they cry out to Rome to come to their aid. And this is what's spoken of in this passage where the ships from Kittim come. And historically, they pulled up with a great fleet and a larger army than what Antiochus had. They come off their ships and they confront Antiochus and say, lay down your arms or fight. And he says, can I think about it? The Roman general comes off, draws a circle around Antiochus, tells him, take all the time you need, just decide before you step out of the circle. Okay, so Antiochus, he lays down his arms, the Roman ships get in and they sell off. He picks up his arms, and he's really mad now. He comes to Jerusalem, and when he gets there, they're having a party because they've heard that he's dead. And that doesn't make things better. Now, when he comes in, it says they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. And this is going to deal with the abomination and desolations. They take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination and desolation. And also we have show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Well, what does that mean? That means that they are going after Hellenism. And that's going to be a major issue of Hanukkah and everything that happens. It's a major issue today. From the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away. Now remember, that is in the middle of the week. 3.5 years in. And the abomination and desolation set up. There will be 1,290 days. And blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. And we'll try to tie these in exactly when they occur and why it's so important. But these are your references to the abomination and desolations out of the book of Daniel. We have what we call the servant passages, or the suffering servant passages, out of the book of Isaiah. Now, from this, we have a lot of information about the death of Yeshua, about the death of the Messiah. And one of the primary passages is going to be Isaiah 52. Everybody know what a Targum is? A Targum is going to be an Aramaic paraphrase of the scripture. And in the Targum, which is the Targum Yonatan ben Uziel, which was the Targum of the prophets, it says in this passage, "Behold my servant," and in the Targum it adds the words "the Messiah." So we know that they saw this as a messianic passage. "Behold, my servant, the Messiah, shall do prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. Just as many were astonished at you, so his visage was more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men." What does that mean? It means he was torn apart. You could not recognize him as a human based upon how they had disfigured his body in the beatings and everything that occurred, right? So we also have out of Isaiah 50, where it says, "I gave my back to those who struck me, and my cheeks to those who plucked out the beard." "I did not hide my face from shame and spitting." Now, I know several of you guys have beards, and your beard is a real sensitive place. I mean, you pull the hair, it hurts. A lot of pain associated with that. I kind of relate it to pulling out the fingernails and putting something underneath the fingernails. But what we're told of the Messiah, basically in Hebrew, it's a little bit more graphic. It says they ripped out the beard. And so you can see how he was disfigured. You can see how he was a bloody mass. But here, we have this described for us. He gave his back, by the way, to those who struck him. We're told, of course, in the New Testament that they took him, the Romans scourged him, and Roman whips had 9 strands on them. They had bone, sharp metal glass. Their purpose, their function was to expose the organs. And we have in the psalm, which is known as the crucifixion psalm, we have, "They gape at me with their mouths, like a raging and roaring lion." In the Hebrew that you have here, it literally means like one would just devour a piece of meat. "I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint." To me, that's just beyond comprehension, because one bone out of joint is extremely painful. "The heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue clings to my jaws. You have brought me to the dust of death, for dogs have surrounded me. The congregation of the wicked has enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones." Now, on that part, it says, "They look and stare at me." And I believe that literally from the whipping, from the scourging, from the beatings that he had, that he's able to look down and able to literally see various bones sticking out. He's able to see organs that are exposed. "They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. We have the story of the burial of Yeshua from Yochanan or John chapter 19. After this, Joseph of Arimathea. Do you know what Arimathea is? It's the Ramat Golan, Golan Heights. Yosef of Arimathea, being a Talmid or disciple of Yeshua, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Yeshua, and Pilate gave him permission. So he came, took the body of Yeshua and Nicodemus, who at first came to Yeshua by night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes. Everybody knows what aloe vera is. And you probably have it at your house for burns. It was used extensively. The aloes, there's numbers of different aloes, but it's used extensively in the perfume and the cosmetic, ancient East. It's also used for medicines, but it's a sap. Now, myrrh is more like a gum until it's processed. So we have about 100 pounds of this. Quite an amount. Then they took the body of Yeshua and bound it in strips of linen with the spices as the custom of the Jews is to bury. I want to go to the book of Yochanan chapter 11. I think last night it must have been that at Tim's house there was a discussion about Eliezer, Lazarus. And we're able to see something of the burial of the Jews during this period. And if we could go to chapter 11, and we'll go to verse 43. Now, when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus," or "Eliezer, come forth." And he who had died came out bound hand and foot with grave clothes. His face was wrapped with a cloth. And Yeshua said to them, "Loose him and let him go." So there's several points that I want to pick up from this. Number one is that he has linen strips that he has been bound with. But obviously it's not one piece, because he's able to walk out of the tomb unaided. He's able to come out on his own power. If it was one piece, he could not do that. Yeshua tells him to unwrap him or unwind him, loose him, and let him go. And we also see that there's a cloth that's over the face, which was the custom. Here we see he's bounded in strips of linen with the spices. So the 100 pounds of myrrh and aloes have been applied to these strips that they're wrapping his body with. Now, next chapter. Now, the first day of the week, Miriam Magdala. Magdala, by the way, is in the north of the Galilee. It's going to be the first town after Tiberias. Tiberias was not allowed for Jews to go in at the time of Yeshua. It was later on, but not at that time. Magdala was where there was a Roman garrison in Tiberias. Magdala was the red light district. And it was 4 miles outside of Tiberias. Went to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. Let me ask, why was the stone taken away from the tomb? Was the stone taken away to let Yeshua out? I don't think so. Later, he's going to appear the same day behind a locked door. So I don't think he had that necessity for the stone to be moved to let him out. Rather, it was to let the people in to see that he wasn't there. So it says, then she ran and came to Shimon Peter and to the other Talmid whom Yeshua loved and said to them, "They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb. We do not know where they have laid him." I want to put it in my words. His body has been snatched. She's not saying he's resurrected. She said they've stolen his body. So Peter therefore went out, and the other Talmid, which would be Yochanan, and were going to the tomb, so they both ran together. It's a panic. So they both ran together, and the other Talmid outran Peter and came to the tomb first. So, in the Tanakh, in the Torah, or in the Tanakh, you might want to jot this down. The most important chapter in Judaism is Bereishit or Genesis 22, it's the Akedah. And that is read every day of the year in the service. Okay? Then, your most important passage is the Shema, with the three portions that go with it. Your most important verse is Zechariah chapter 14, verse 9, where it says, the Lord is one. Okay, so in the Akedah, the word that you want to watch for is to see. That's the key to the... Also, in Yochanan chapter 20, is to see. It says that he's stooping down. This is going to be Shemot. And he's stooping down. He got to the tomb first. Looked in. Excuse me, this would be Yochanan. And then he's stooping down and looking in. He saw. See the word basically see. He saw the linen cloth lying. Now the there is just italicized. Okay? So what he sees is the linen cloths. Yet he did not go in. Then Shimon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb, and he saw the linen cloths lying. And the handkerchief that had been around his head, remember that's like the cloth that was over the head of Eliezer, around his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded together in a place by itself. I've wondered about why was it folded. I think because if a thief came in, everything would be just tossed. Here we have order. And so then the other Talmid who came to the tomb first went in also, and he saw and believed. Well, what did he believe? Obviously, based upon what we read after this, he believed that he was resurrected. They realized that his body had not been snatched, but that it had been resurrected based upon what they saw, and the whole emphasis has been on these linen cloths and the handkerchief. Yes?
Not only that, that Yeshua himself did it in a way that they knew it was him that folded, and it wasn't faked by someone else.
Very good. So, we're told that as yet, they did not know the scripture that he must rise from the dead. So it's not based upon scripture. It's based upon what they see. Then the Talmid went away again to their own homes. So, what did they see? Why was the linen cloth on the other side of the room? I think if the linen cloth was on the other side of the room, exactly for the same reason that the stone was rolled away. If you put myrrh and aloes onto the cloths and you leave them for 3 days, they harden. So basically what you've created is a cast. But the cast is empty. But as long as the cloth was over the face, you would have no idea. You would think the body was still inside the cast. By removing, I mean, it almost is comical. You could picture them coming up and trying to look down into the cast to see if maybe he's shrunk and he's at the other end. But here, you can't steal the cast. You can't steal the body without taking the cast. If you leave the cast, you're left with, he rose from the dead. So it's a very powerful passage. Shroud of Turin. A lot of controversy about this. First off, let me say to you that I don't believe the Shroud of Turin is a fake. But I don't believe it's the burial cloth of Yeshua. Okay, I believe that it's something that's demonic. And want to talk about it. This is a image that is created from the face, taken directly off the face. All that's been done here is it's been enhanced a little bit. We might, is there a light that we can kind of cut some of the lights for a few moments, just a few moments. This is an image of processing that pulls out the distinguishing features. And this was done by back in the 70s. And they discovered, using this process, they discovered right here. You can see where the eye is, that right here, that is a coin. Now, this coin, this is from our local newspaper, the Beaumont Enterprise, and it says, a misspelling on a rare Pontus Pilate coin helped convince researchers that human imprints of the Shroud of Turin, believed to be the burial cloth of Jesus Christ, are genuine and date back to the first century. Magnifications of the rare coin believed widely used around Palestine until 70 AD. I'm kind of aggravated that they're calling it Palestine, because at that time it was not called Palestine, it was called Judea. And today it's not called Palestine, it's called Israel. But to cover the eyes of the dead showed the same misspelling found in the Shroud imprint. And Loyola University theologian said Tuesday, the Reverend Francis L. Phyllis said the matching misspellings prove the Shroud originated around the same time and place Christ was crucified during Pilate's reign. And then it goes on that the Shroud believed to be Christ's burial cloth has been preserved since 1578 in the Cathedral of Turin, Italy. Now, this you're not able to see here, but this is a book. Excuse me, this is not a book. This is out of Biblical Archaeology Review. And Biblical Archaeology Review is the leading American magazine on biblical archaeology. And it's one of the leading magazines in the world on biblical archaeology. Several years ago, they discovered what is called the Peace Forest, which is in Jerusalem. They discovered the tomb of Joseph Caiaphas. Now, the tomb is a family tomb, and there were a number of tombs. And basically what they have, they literally found Caiaphas' ossuary, which is the box that his bones were placed in. They also found ossuaries from other family members, and they found inside the coins that had been placed on the eyes or the mouth of the dead. What was the purpose of these? Well, it comes from paganism. It comes from Hellenism. It comes from the Greek belief that there is the underworld, there is a river, the Styx River. And when you die, you're going to be on the forebank of the Styx River. The place of the dead is on the other side. You go to the underworld, and there's a boatman. And you have to pay the boatman a coin to take you over to the land of the dead. So the dead are buried with these. Let me tell you, Messiah has to fulfill the scripture. You know, when he was on the cross, we had it prophesied. They would cast lots for his clothes. When he was on the cross, if he would have said to the Romans, Don't tear my garment, because it'll break the prophecy. It'll break the scripture. That we're told in the book of Vayikra, Leviticus, that Messiah is to be a king, he's to be priest, he's to be prophet. And one of the requirements, Leviticus chapter 21 and verse 10, of the high priest is he cannot tear his garment. But when I was a kid, we read this story, what is it, Brer Rabbit or whatever? And he's thrown in the bush with all the briars. Is that what the right story? And how he gets out is he says to the coyote or the wolf, don't do this. And the wolf just does it. Whatever he says don't do, he does, and that's how he gets out of there. But the whole thing is that when Yeshua's on the tree, it's out of his hands, but he cannot break the scripture. He cannot be buried as a pagan. He's the Messiah of Israel. And therefore, he could not be buried with coins on his eyes. That in itself disqualifies the Shroud of Turin. Here, you're able to see the man on the shroud. This is from a book on the evidence for the Shroud of Turin. The man in the shroud appears to have been buried with coins in his eyes, a first century Jewish custom. Francis L. Phileas, professor at Loyola University in Chicago, believes he can date the shroud by matching the ancient coin with the shape and detail of these objects. The coin is a lepton, minted by Pontius Pilate in Palestine, or in Israel, in 31 or 32 AD. The photo below compares a lepton of a simply different shape with an enlargement of the right eye area of the shroud image. The eye area enlargement shows shadowy outlines of a staff, Greek letters at upper left, and the angle of the side of the coin at upper right. Now, this is the enlargement of the coin over the eye. I grew up in Port Arthur, and I'm going to assume most everybody but Scott here has been in Texas long enough that you know where everything is. And Port Arthur is just south of Beaumont. We have just, we can try go from Port Arthur to Groves to Port Neches, so we're talking about maybe 5 miles from where I grew up. We have Port Neches, Texas. Back in 1969, we had a screen door that appeared in Port Neches that had the image of Jesus on it. Now, I want to read a little bit about this. How many of you know about the screen door? All right, let me tell you a little about it. A miraculous manifestation of Jesus Christ appeared on the screen door of a modest home in 1969. The neighborhood swelled with believers and the curious until the owner removed the door and hid it. It was later reattached, still visible, into the early 1980s. It's been gone since the 1980s. The miracle, I saw the image as a little girl of about 11 years old in the 70s. It actually was in 1969 it appeared. It was very detailed and unmistakably Jesus. I still live in Port Neches, and as of 2013, the image is still gone. At the time I saw him, the crowd was electric, but quite the reverent. It was amazing to see. This is small. These are different people speaking about him. I don't want to go forward. Last sentence here. It seems that when this miracle appeared in the 1960s, crowds grew so large that the owner had to remove the door and hide it. By the way, they had over 500,000 people come to this yard. Okay, this is this was copied from the front page of the Port Arthur News on June 17, 1969. Throngs attracted by image on door, Port Neches. Hundreds of persons, young and old, are making their way to the backyard of the CPB residence, something Avenue C, to view an image which some say is a likeness of Jesus on the back screen door of the home. Mrs. B, a longtime resident of Port Neches, well known for her Christian devotion, discovered what appears to be a profile of Jesus Christ visible on the plastic-coated screen door on the back of her house. Upon discovering the image, Mrs. B notified a neighbor, and word quickly spread over the area, causing more than 1,000 persons as of Monday. Now, this continued on. To make the pilgrimage to the B backyard to view the image. People have come from as far away as Houston. People came from Europe. And cars with Louisiana license plates have been seen. This is just right when it first happened. Mrs. B said it's not painted or drawn, and in no way does it appear to be fake. When viewed at the correct angle of vision, and with the sun shining through the fig tree to the door's left, there is a visible an image similar to the wildly marketed portraits of Jesus Christ. Same image that you have on the Shroud of Turin. Okay, so according to W. B., son of Mr. and Mrs. B., viewers have arrived shortly after dawn and stayed as late as 1:15 a.m. since Thursday, trying to catch a better view of the image. Port Neches police chief said the lawn is littered with lunch bags, ice cream, beverage cups, Polaroid camera discards, and other debris. Police are keeping the area under security. By the way, within 3 weeks, there wasn't a blade of grass left in the yard from so many people that had come in. And though most people are observing traffic and parking regulations, traffic has been blocked several times. No tickets have been issued, he said. steady flow of onlookers crowded the backyard Monday, climbing trees, walking through flower beds, trying to get a better look. Many touched, rubbed their hands across the indented portion of the screen door. Several portions have tried to carry the door away. The question many people who have viewed the image are asking is, what does it mean? The Reverend S.N., pastor, gave his feelings and definitions of the apparition. If you'll notice, the image is looking toward that fig tree, which is approximately 10 yards to the left of the door. He is not looking straight out or to the other side. He is looking at the fig tree, which is figurative of the Jewish nation, he said. I feel the image is predicting the second coming of Christ and his change from a Gentile to a Jew. I'm sorry. I'm not going to read the rest of this, but I just want to talk about it. Listen, they have had images of Jesus on tacos. They've had images of Jesus that have appeared in all kinds of ways. And people say, well, this is proof of the resurrection. This is proof that he's real. It's not proof, it's a lie. This is a deception. And this is a deception that is dangerous. Because we're going to have in the future one that's going to come. And we call him, in English or in Christianity, he's called the Antichrist. Anti means against. I think it's the wrong way to look at it. He's the false Messiah. He's a counterfeit. He's giving what people are looking for, and he's close enough that people won't question, at least for the majority of the public. There is a conditioning that is going on, and people are being conditioned to what does he look like. So I went out and saw that. I mean, everybody went out and saw that. So, this is an article. This is my. This appeared in our Bowman Enterprise, and I went online and found, because I didn't have the date for this article, I cut it out years and years and years ago, but I went online a couple days ago, and I found the same information, and I'm going to tell you how you can find it. Okay, so. Shrouded Turin provided model as early as 31 AD, experts say. A Shrouded Turin scholar says new research indicates the facial image on the shroud, considered by some to be the burial cloth of Jesus Christ, provided the model for depictions of godlike figures as early as 31 AD. These findings date the shroud to the time of the crucifixion, said as many historians and theologians at 30 AD. I would agree with that. I believe 30 AD is going to be the time. And refute claims that the controversial cloth is a 14th century fraud, said Dr. Alan D. Wenger, a Duke University professor of psychiatry and member of the Association of Scientists and Scholars International for the Shroud of Turin. He said he believes they also indicate that the facial image of the shroud was well known and represented the deity to the people of the time. Wenger said he and his wife and co-researcher Mary found 79 points of similarity or congruence between the shroud and a carved relief of Zeus Kyrios. Now, Zeus Kyrios, Zeus means, of course, that's the Greek god, equivalent to the Roman Jupiter, to the English Jove. The Kyrios means like Lord of Heaven. So dated by its own inscription to 31 AD, when he compared them through the polarized image overlay technique he developed in 1981. In a court of law, 45 to 60 points of congruence are sufficient to establish the identity of the same source of face images. He said that there is excellent evidence that the facial image of Zeus Kyrios was based on that of the Shroud of Turin. I want to reverse that. I believe that the Shroud of Turin is based on the was based upon the image or the face of Zeus Kyrios. Lending support to the belief that the face of the shroud was available either directly or through excellent detailed copies of the artist carving the relief. I'm going to go forward. This is the article that I found on the internet. It's going to say basically this is the urge for some fresh independent means of dating the shroud, the modus vivendi behind the late Father Phyllis's coin hypothesis, which we saw earlier, has found an unexpected expression in a new claim by Duke University psychiatrist Dr. Alan Wagner that he has found signs of influence from the shroud image on a relief sculpture of Zeus Kyrios, precisely datable to AD 31, found at Duros Europus on the Euphrates. According to Wagner, by using the polarized image overlay technique, we captured the image of Zeus with the face image of the shroud of Turin, it found a very good match of 79 points of congruence. Now, do you understand what we're talking about with points of congruence? In other words, that you make a positive identification and it would hold up in a court as being legally the same image or the same impression. And I don't know if you watch all the stuff on television with the DNA and, you know, forensics and so forth, but they kind of do a lot of this kind of stuff. So we have, they're sufficient to establish the identity of the same source of face images. In other words, what he's saying is Zeus Kyrios, the image of Zeus Kyrios was based on that of the Shroud of Turin. That the face of Jesus should have been used within 2 years, the earliest likely date for the crucifixion, as a model for the pagan statue of the King of Gods, is in itself quite sufficient to put an intolerable strain on our credulity. Okay, let's go forward. Told you that the word in Hebrew is sikut somat, means abomination, desolation. And the word sikut specifically refers to idols, to images. Okay? And where you have and to customs derived from idolatry, that is only customs that are related directly to the image. Sikuts. This is from the Tyndale's Illustrated Bible Dictionary. Now, the article that I just read to you was from the article called Abomination. Okay, out of the Tyndale's Illustrated Bible Dictionary. This is the Desolating Sacrilege article out of the same dictionary. I'm going to read this. I know it's too little for you to look at, but the important part I'm going to have an enlargement of, because I want you to be able to see it. I am a firm believer in people being able to say, I saw it for myself, or I have the exact reference. Desolating sacrilege, abomination and desolation. The phrase sikut somat occurs first in Daniel 12:11 with variants in Daniel 9:27 and 11:31. Sikut, an offensive object due to uncleanness. When an idol is offensive to God, sikut somat probably represents a contemptuous equivalent for Baal somat, which is Lord of Heaven. The Lord is a mere idol. Okay, now, this gets kind of technical, but this is what's called, in linguistics research, a MND, a Midrashic name derivation. And it's where that you have a play in the Hebrew on the words. Okay, so, Lord of Heaven, the Lord is a mere idol, and he is not of heaven, Samin, but he desolates Somin. The name appears to have in view. Okay, this is the important part. The name appears to have in view the action of Antiochus Epiphanes, who placed on the altar in the Jerusalem temple a small idolatrous altar, described in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 54 and following. as the desolating sacrilege. And we have the Greek for how you would say desolating sacrilege. With it, according to Jewish tradition, went an image, almost certainly of Zeus, Lord of Heaven, Zeus Kyrios, bearing the Empress Lycus. Now that becomes amazing. In other words, Antiochus was so full of himself, and he, as many others would do in the ancient world, he declares himself God. And so the image that he places, that's called the Abomination of Desolations, not only is an image of Zeus Kyrios, but he puts his own face onto the image of Zeus Kyrios. And all of the images of Zeus Kyrios from that point will have the image of Antiochus Epiphanes. But wait a second. The image of Antiochus Epiphanes, excuse me, the image of Zeus Kyrios is the same image that's on the Shroud of Turin, which is the same image that was on the screen door of Port Natchez, which is the same image that is on all the tacos, which is the same image that's in all the Sunday school quarterlies, the same image that's in all the churches. And you have a great deception. And all of a sudden it goes to a new level when you start to think initially and you hear, well, he has the same face as the Shroud of Turin. Well, the Shroud of Turin, I don't believe in that. But when you start to play it out, it becomes a horror story. That the people believe that they are following after God, and it's a deception. So it says, with it, according to Jewish tradition, with an image almost certainly of Zeus, the Lord of Heaven, bearing the Empress likeness, this sacrilege created desolation. In other words, not destruction, but desolating horror, or possibly making the temple to be desolate, emptied of God and his true worshipers. This is the first article. I had these out of line, but you see number two. Sikkuts referred to idols. Here we have what I told you, the enlargement of that second part. But he desolates so when the name appears to have in view the action of Antiochus Epiphanes, who placed on the altar in Jerusalem temple, a small idolatrous altar described in 1 Maccabees 154 as the desolating sacrifice. With it, according to Jewish tradition, with an image almost certain of Zeus, the Lord of Heaven, bearing the Emperor's likeness. Okay, I want to show you. People would identify that as being an image of Jesus. Zeus. That's Zeus Kyrios. In other words, this is not an image that comes from Christianity. It's an image that comes from Greek mythology. Zeus Kyrios. We even know what Antiochus looked like. This is from the Jewish Encyclopedia. You can go to it online. And we have this coin of Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes, without a beard. Look at it with a beard. Looks like the images of Jesus, doesn't it? You know, there is a book. The author, I didn't agree with a lot of his stuff, but a lot of his stuff was really good. His name was Vindel Jones. He passed away a few years ago. But he had the best book cover I've ever seen. And what was the show? To Tell the Truth? Or What's My Line? To Tell the Truth. How many of you know this show? We catch all the really old ones at this point. Okay. But you have this panel, and everybody probably knows who Betty White is. She was one of the panel members. And this is, I think, probably in the 50s. that this.
And it's Dorothy Kilgnell.
Yeah.
Maggie Carmel.
What you have is you have these three people come out, and they're going to claim to be something like, you know, I go down into existing volcanoes or something, and you know they have this weird profession, and then they each are going to claim to be this, and then the panel's going to ask them questions to figure out which is the right one, and at the end it says, well, the real so-and-so, please stand up. So Vendel comes out with this book, and it's called Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? And you have three different Jesuses behind this table. So over on your left-hand side, you have the Protestant Jesus. So he's got almost blonde hair, and it's long. It comes down to here. By the way, if he had long hair, he cannot be Messiah because he's breaking scripture. Okay, number two, he has blue eyes. He has a white garment on. He's got a shepherd's crook, and he's holding a lamp. Okay, Protestant Jesus. Next to him, we have Catholic Jesus. He's the suffering Jesus. He has a crown of thorns. His face is real gaunt. He's got a little bit of blood coming down here. He has a heart right here, you know, red heart that's shaped like a Valentine heart. And then he's got this purple robe on. Okay, so then next to him, you have this scruffy-looking rabbi character. And the idea is, will the real Jesus please stand up? People have been programmed to follow an expectation that is not only unrealistic, it is actually going to come out of Hellenism, come out of paganism of the worst sort. You know, the abomination of desolation. We think of the abomination of desolation in reference to Antiochus. In early Antiochus. But this is from the article out of the Jewish Encyclopedia published by Funk and Wagnalls. Last edition that was published was in 1914. And this is the section called In Rabbinical Literature. The rabbis as a whole consider that the expression refers to the desecration of the temple by the erection of a Zeus statue in its sacred precincts by Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, so it refers you to another article, as well as what you could read in the forerunner, or the first part of the article on abomination desolation. Some rabbis, however, see it in it an allusion to Menashe, who is related in 2 Chronicles 33, verse 7, set up a carved image in the house of God. Yeah, this is going to be discussed in the Jerusalem Talmud in the Tractate Tanit 68a. It's also going to be in Rashi's discussion of the passage in the Talmud Bavli in Tanit 28b. Okay, so why is that important? Well, you're able to see from this the antiquity, how far back that they made this association. So this is going to take us back. Tanit actually was written about the time of Yeshua. So the Haggadah. Haggadah is going to be the story around it. Okay, narrates that two statues were erected by Menashe, one of which fell over upon the other and broke off its head. Upon the severed hand, the following inscription was found engraved. I sought to destroy God's house, but thou didst lend thy hand to its protection. We're going to go back and look at the passages in the Tanakh. But he did evil in the sight of the Lord. This is talking about Menashe. By the way, Menashe is a picture of the false Messiah. He's going to parallel what we know will be done by the false Messiah. Have you ever noticed that in the scripture, you don't have where it tells you something once. It tells it to you repeatedly, over and over and over, and from different perspectives, from different angles. So we don't have one place that it tells us about the false Messiah. It could be all over. Haman's a picture of the false Messiah. Pharaoh's a picture of the false Messiah. Antiochus is a picture of the false Messiah. And we put all these together and we get a profile. Okay, so Manasseh is a picture of the false Messiah. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the abominations of the nations, whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel, for he rebuilt the Bamut, the high places, which Hezekiah or Hezekiah's father had broken down. He raised up altars for the Baalim, or the made wooden images, Asherah. Now, Asherah is going to be an important word to us. And he worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. He also built altars in the house of the Lord, in which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem shall my name be forever. And he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. Also he caused his sons to pass through the fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. He practiced soothsaying, used witchcraft and sorcery, consulted mediums and spiritualists. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. He even set up a carved image, the idol, which he had made in the house of God. Now, it's very interesting. Remember, in the Agadah, it had that there were two images. And that's going to be based upon how, in the various passages, we have it, the word spelled. So, you have to bear with me on this part. How many of you know a little bit of Hebrew? All right? You have, in Hebrew, your words are divided into masculine and feminine. So if we say the word Asherah, what is it? Masculine or feminine? It's feminine because the ah suffix of the word makes it feminine. Like Torah is a feminine word. Okay? But if we say Asherim, what is that? Male. Asherah is going to be feminine singular. And so your plural is Asherot. But we do not have a masculine singular. We only have masculine plural, Asherim. Okay? So bear that in mind. But there are going to be two images. It's brought out in the Agadah, but it is not just a legend, because it's actually supported in the way the Hebrew letters of the Tanakh are spelled. Okay? That's the important point to remember. He even set up a carved image, the idol which he made, in the house of God, of which God had said to David and to Shlomo, or Solomon, his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever, and I will not again remove the foot of Israel from the land which I have appointed for your fathers. That's future tense. Only if they are careful to do all that I have commanded them according to the whole Torah and the statutes and the ordinances by the hand of Moshe. So Manasseh seduced Yehuda and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel. And the Lord spoke to Manasseh and his people, and they would not listen. But when his son, this is Josephus. And we're going to pick up a little bit from Josephus. But when his son Manasseh, whose mother's name was Hephzibah of Jerusalem, and taken the kingdom, he departed from the conduct of his father and fell into a course of life contrary thereto, showed himself in his manners most wicked in all respects, and admitted no sort of impiety, but imitated those transgressions of the Israelites by the commission of which against God they had been killed. For he even dared to defile the temple of God, and the city, and the whole country. For by setting out from a contempt of God, he barbarously slew all the righteous men. Revelation, Daniel. It says that the false Messiah who's coming will wage war against the Tzaddikim, the righteous ones. And for 3.5 years, he'll prevail. We have Manasseh, literally. We have through all the righteous men that were among the Hebrews, nor would he spare the prophets, for he every day slew some of them. I don't know if you know this. According to Josephus, he placed the prophet Isaiah in a log. He had the log sewn in two, till Jerusalem was overflown with blood. We're told, I mentioned this before, from Kohelet or Ecclesiastes, That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? Is already been in ancient times before us? We also have from chapter 3. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing taken from it. God does it. That men should fear before him. That which has already been and what is to be has already been. God requires an account of what has passed. This is from Isaiah 45. Tell and bring forth your case. Yes, let them take counsel together. Who has declared this from the ancient time? Who has told it from that time? Have not I, the Lord, and there is no other God besides me? A just God and a Savior, there is none besides me. Look to me and be saved, all you ends of the earth, for I am God, there is no other. I'm going to run through a little bit. I'm going to come back to the Asherah, Asherim. So I just want to make sure that we're kind of all headed in the same direction. We have this prophecy that we started with out of Daniel chapter 9, verse 24. We read verse 27. Okay, but this is verse 24. This is where the prophecy starts. And I want you to notice something. By the way, what does Hanukkah mean? Dedication. Why do we call it this?
Rededication.
It was the rededication of the temple. Okay, so we have a prophecy looking to the future, 70 weeks or 70 seven-year periods are determined for your people, Israel, for your holy city, Jerusalem, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Most Holy. In Hebrew, the word that you have here is Kodesh HaKodeshim. What is that? That is the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant sit, the throne of God on earth. It is the most holy site in the world. But it has to be anointed. Why does it have to be anointed? It has to anoint is an act of bestowing kedusha or sanctification. But it is the most sanctified area in the world, so why does it have to be anointed? But the prophecy ends with this. Know therefore and understand that for the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks, which is 49 years, and 62 weeks, which is 362. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troublesome times. But after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. Now here, the people of the prince who is to come. This is the bad guy. This is the false Messiah. Shall destroy the city. Destroy it. Jerusalem. It was done by Titus. And the sanctuary. By Titus, the Roman emperor. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. In the verse we read before, that he, the false Messiah, the prince who is to come, shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 7-year period, but in the middle of the 7 years, the false Messiah shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. We have in chapter 7, I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the Zadokim, the righteous ones, prevailing against them. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints or the righteous ones of the Most High, shall intend to change laws, which is the word zimdin, and law, dot, is the Aramaic word for Torah. Then the saints, the Zadokim, the righteous ones, shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time, 3.5 years. Now, we can see a parallel with Antiochus Epiphanes. We can see it. That's the Maccabean Wars. We can see the same parallel going back further in history with Manasseh. Revelation. So they worship the dragon. This is chapter 13. Who gave authority to the beast. And they worship the beast. The beast is the false Messiah. In Hebrew, in Revelation 13, he is described as a seven-headed beast living in the sea, right? That rises out. Where do we find that description of that beast in the Tanakh, in the Hebrew scriptures?
Job. Eel.
Yes, in the book of Job, and in the Psalms, and in actually chapter 1 of Genesis, in the book of Isaiah, it's called Leviathan. Leviathan was a seven-headed beast that dwelt in the midst of the sea. And so we have all these pictures back in the Tanakh that we have here. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with you? And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. He is given authority to continue for 42 months, 3.5 years. Then he opened his mouth and blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the Tzaddikim, the righteous ones, and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So we have with Manasseh, and we're going to put Antiochus in here too. He put up an abomination of desolation. He makes war against the Tzaddikim. And we have exactly the same thing with the false Messiah. Let me talk for just a moment. The false Messiah who's coming. I said this before. There's a passage. Let me read this to you. This is found in the book of Ezekiel. This is Ezekiel chapter 21, verse 25. Now to you, O profane, wicked prince of Israel, whose day has come, whose iniquity shall end. The profane, wicked prince of Israel is the false Messiah. So the false Messiah, when he comes, is going to claim to be the Jesus of Christianity. How many people are following? I don't know. 500,000 people came to Port Neches, Texas to see a screen door. We have people all over declare the Shroud of Turin is the burial cloth of Yeshua. You know, this is December. And we have people, the reason for the season is Jesus. The nativity signs that they put on their used to put on their televisions, you can't anymore. Okay, but they're in front of people's houses. All that they have over and over, this Jesus is one that's coming from Hellenism. It's coming from a counterfeit that has more similarity to Greece and Rome than it has to the scriptures. The Christmas story, full of errors, full of half-truths. So, I'll finish up with this in just a second. We already looked at this. It says, the point in time he shall return and go toward the south. This is ships from Kittim. We have forces mustered by they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place them in the abomination of desolation. We have, at that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. There should be a time of trouble. This is the 7 years. such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time, and at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified, made white, and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there should be 1,290 days. I'll come back to that. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Tim, do you want to stop and take a break? And I can pick this up as a part two.
Whatever you want to do.
I can go ahead, but, you know.
We got two more sessions.
Yeah, I mean, I can talk, believe me. I don't have to divide it up. I can do this all at once, or I can...
Just divide it up.
Okay, we'll do that. We'll stop here. This is a good place to stop. Okay, the only thing is, you can't forget anything. Okay,
there's
because
test.
Yeah, and everything's going to depend on you remembering it all, and you've got to connect the dots. Okay, all right.
Maybe Joe will review a little bit here when he comes back. So, okay, let's go ahead and take a break here for about 15 minutes. We're going to come back and we're going to schedule. We're going to do a chorus study and song and dance and stuff like that, and then Joe will pick it back up. About 1:30. Come on. Give him a break here.